the Deborah E. Lake Show, and I am glad to bring this guest that I have to talk with you tonight and to share her wisdom tonight. She's been a journalist covering gay issues and concerns since 1984, a longtime journalist for gay rights and concerns. She's the publisher and executive editor for Windy City Media Group, which produces Windy City Times and Night Sports. And she's the editor of the book called Out and Proud in Chicago. This is the first comprehensive book on Chicago's gay history. She was also the executive producer of the lesbian feature film Hannah Free back in 2008. That's Sharon Glass was the star of that. I am privileged and honored to have Tracy Bain on the show, and she's going to talk about her new book that just came out not too long ago, Obama and the Gays. Hello, Tracy. How are you?
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, glad to have you on here. And what I want to do is just have some of your wisdom and get some of your thoughts. We have a lot of things that have been going on in political scenes, and your book, that the most recent book that you have out, Obama and the Gays. I think that's something that, as you touch on in your introduction to the book, that hasn't really been explored. So I guess one of the things I gave a brief intro before I brought you on, but one of the things I'd like for you to talk about to start off is what, other than the fact that it hasn't been really covered, what brought you to bring this book together?
Well, I witnessed firsthand a lot of the years of Obama in Chicago politics and saw how much and how important the gay community was to his trajectory on gay rights. Gay people were very much a part of his 2004 U.S. Senate campaign, for example, and also during the presidential campaign, all of the Democrats were courting the gay community for votes and dollars. And so we played a pivotal role in that election, just as we have in Clinton and Carter years as well. But I think in the 2008 election in particular, the pressure from the gay community really forced Democrats to go on record in a lot of ways on our issues, and I felt that that was being lost to the history books. As you saw a lot of Obama books come out earlier this year, there was very little about that constituency group and its impact on Obama's career as well as his promises to the community in the 2008 election.
Well, I'm wondering, why do you think that is, with having such an important role in a historical presidency, candidacy and presidency, why do you think that got lost?
I think a lot of times these overview books about candidates and campaigns, that the constituency groups are always lost, that it's all about the, you know, insiders and the big-name people that are involved, forgetting the fact that, especially because this was such a grassroots campaign, that it was the everyday gays and lesbians and straight folks that helped both Hillary Clinton and Obama get as far as they did in 2008. So my goal was to both make sure that gay people were not lifted out of the history books, but also make sure that Chicagoans weren't forgotten for the role they played in his career. You know, there's lots of interviews with Chicagoans and former Chicagoans in the back of the book to talk about their early support of him and their trust in him and how that, you know, paid off later in terms of his support for the gay community. So I really feel like any one book that's an overview of the candidate can't do it. It's up to kind of us as constituency groups to really get in the down and dirty details as opposed to just a surface look at who his supporters were.
Mm, yeah, that's true. That is so true. Tell me, have you seen his support or his position change over the course of his career as a politician?
Well, when he first ran in 1996, he was running for a state Senate office. So most of the questions had to do with state issues. But marriage was an issue in the state at that time. The Defense of Marriage Act in Illinois, as well as nationally, were being debated during that year that he was running. He never had to actually vote on it because it already became law in Illinois before he took office. But so the question did come up on our very first survey of him in 1996, his Outlines newspaper, and he said he was for gay marriage at that point. Pretty much on all the other issues, he also was in agreement with the gay community. the main issue that he has changed course on, and I would say it's both a revolving door and a devolving door, is on marriage. He was for us before he was against us, and now he's kind of saying he might be for it again. So he just really has a political problem with it, and now he claims it's also a religious issue, which really muddied the waters for gay people when he ran for Senate in 2004. We can understand practical political decisions on marriage, but when he then injected later in the campaign religion into it, people were very uncomfortable because he, of all people, being a constitutional lawyer, knows about the separation of church and state. So that made people a little bit uncomfortable. But overall, generally on the issues, he's very strong. I think it's the strategy where a lot of people disagree with him and are frustrated, especially in the first couple of years, with the kind of evade tactics, delay tactics with the Department of Justice appealing pro-gay rulings, all sorts of things that have frustrated his gay base.
Yes, and some people think that he might, they say he threw the issue of marriage, sort of like threw it under the bus, dropped it like a hot potato when it became uncomfortable. So I think some people would question his real energy behind his support. And I'm wondering what you found when you were putting the book together.
Well, with marriage, absolutely. Marriage is not going to be an issue right now that a president, I think they should. I think it's a courageous stance, and you stand on the right side of history that way. But I can understand on marriage, and a lot of people actually do have a patience on him with marriage at a federal level. What they want is for his Department of Justice not to stand in the way of court victories on marriage or on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Right now, the Department of Justice is in the process of appealing pro-gay rulings on those cases. It is an option for the White House to push for appealing those decisions, and they have chosen to appeal those pro-gay victories. And that's what's frustrating for people, because the higher up it goes, there's a very strong risk that the Supreme Court will not approve these things and therefore set the community back for a long time. He wants to seek legislative change, but obviously now with the midterm elections, legislative change is almost impossible. The Don't Ask, Don't Tell bill could possibly get through in the lame duck session because it's already passed through the House and it just needs the Senate. But The Defense of Marriage Act is never going to come up in this administration in these next 2 years. People really didn't expect that. What they really want, if there was to be a positive movement, the expectation is twofold. One is the Employment Non-Discrimination Act and the Uniting Families Immigration Act. Those two things are not as controversial and should be able to get through. They probably won't in the House. But Don't Ask, Don't Tell will likely wind its way through the courts and possibly need to have a stop-loss order from the president to at least delay the discharges for some time. And secondly, to not appeal through the Department of Justice these rulings that are positive. That's the way traditionally a lot of these more difficult civil rights issues are decided, is in the courts. That's what happened in the women's movement, and that's what happened in the American Civil Rights Movement. So let the courts make these decisions at the level they are now. If you appeal to the Supreme Court, it's very likely with the makeup of the current Supreme Court that it will strike it down. So that's, I think, the next couple of years are kind of a very difficult couple of years legislatively, but there could at least be some progress in the courts.
Yeah, there could be. So let's go back. You've been writing about for Gay Press since 1984. And one of the things that I really like to do is to get some of the wisdom that you have covering all of that's a long time. That's a big span of time. What are some of the things that you've seen, trends or changes, or what's the given now that was like, oh my gosh, that would be a dream back when you first started? Tell us about just the journey of gay history.
Well, when I started at Gay Life newspaper in 1984, I was 21 years old, and there were fewer than 100 AIDS cases in Chicago. The first few years of my journalism career in Chicago were predominated by AIDS coverage, and really kind of in the middle of a war zone. It was just a treacherous time for our community, and going to funerals and covering people before their death, and lots of people affected at the newspaper. So it was a really, really traumatic time in our community's history. People are still dying today, but the waves that were dying and the quickness was just like a war zone. Secondly, in Chicago, Mayor Harold Washington was mayor when I first started. I was able to interview him in 1986, and he was a really terrific proponent of gay civil rights. And the gay rights ordinance in Chicago was at its peak in terms of pushing for it. It failed under Washington, in part because of the city council wars. And then a year and a half later, it passed under Mayor Eugene Sawyer. So that was a really peak time in our community, as well as there were marches on Washington and all sorts of organizations that just started in the mid-1980s, some of them still around today. Mm-hmm. The things that I don't think we would have thought would have happened by now is, you know, marriage is legal in several U.S. states at this point and several countries around the world. I think in 1985, if someone would have told me that it would happen that quickly, I would have absolutely thought they were insane. the speed with which our movement has succeeded compared to other civil rights movements is incredible, and it's certainly on the backs of those civil rights movements because they moved our country forward in ways that allowed gay rights to even happen and succeed. So I feel like very, very fortunate to have been in kind of the middle, to have benefited from the early years of gay activists before me, those who started in even the 1920s, but certainly significantly in the 60s and 70s. And then I was able to come in 84 and witness kind of the middle age of our movement. And now we're moving into the next phase. And it's really exciting and really unpredictable. You know, we could move to a country right now that's more like 1930s Germany before Hitler's peak, or we could move into a more progressive era if people wake up and vote strategically instead of emotionally on these issues. So right now, our country's kind of at a pivot point, and it could go one way or the other. It's both scary as well as I try to be an optimist, and I hope that the country does wake up again as they did in 2008. But, you know, you just never know which way our country might go.
Yeah. No, Americans, if nothing else, we can be very unpredictable. You never know what will happen. I think that's what makes it wonderful living here. What do you think is, you talked about a little bit about, there's a couple of things I want to talk about. One's racism in the gay community. But while you were talking, I was listening, and you talked about the emotion, rather than vote your emotion, vote what's good for, you know. What do you think is driving that emotion? Some of the things that, I know that's not one particular thing, but what are some of the things behind, for instance, the emotion that's behind marriage?
Right. You know what? This gay discrimination that happens on an everyday basis is a very personal thing to people. So when a president, for example, says, let's delay this one more year, or let's make a study on this, or let's do this, or let's do that, the first reaction you have is emotional and say, no, it's our turn. It's our turn, and you promised this. So your response is emotional and say, well, if you're not going to give me this, I'm going to take my ball and go home. I'm either not going to vote or I'm going to vote for your opponent just to punish you. And in this election, 30% of the gay community that was polled voted Republican. Now, those are not all Republican gays. Some of those people voted in protest. And no, many people stayed home. The Democrats, I think, really underestimated the delay impacting people in terms of their motivation. People said, well, you know what, if you're not for me, why should I help you, even if that hurts me? And that's what I don't get. I've never not voted in an election in my entire adult life. I don't understand that strategy, even when I've had to hold my nose and vote. I've voted. And if I don't vote if someone doesn't want to vote for the top of the ticket, there's many other people down below that need your support. So I think a lot of people stayed away from this time. They had an easy excuse not to. Part of my reason for writing the book is that I think people really, first of all, Obama and his team did not communicate very well the last 2 years on their successes. They allowed the message to be turned around on them by the Republicans, so that was their fault. But I also believe that voters have an obligation to inform themselves. And the book was meant to put all in one place, everything that not only Obama promised, but also all of the things he did deliver in the first 2 years in office, despite the horrible economy and the wars and the environment. He actually did a tremendous amount of things that affected millions of gay people on an everyday basis, on health care issues, on United Nations resolutions, on things that actually matter to everyday people's lives, including health care. I think they just did a really bad job of communicating it, and I also think the equally burdensome, it's up to the voter to really educate themselves, that none of that stuff would have happened had McCain been in office. And in fact, there might have been, you know, even a further strengthening of the anti-gay stuff. So a fully educated voter, I think, would have surmised that a lot has been done and that there should be at least 2 more years to prove out what they said they would do. When he said he would do these things, he didn't say, I will do these things in 18 months. He didn't. He never made that promise. Some of these things take a little bit longer time. So emotion means it gets in the way of a strategic thinking, saying that what is the best course of action, even if I'm upset, but I don't have my full equality yet.
Okay, well, here's your opportunity to educate some of my listeners. Tell a couple of things that Obama has in his administration, what they've accomplished over the last 18 months.
Okay, so first of all, health care, because of the pre-existing conditions clause, if that is able to stay in despite the Republicans, that means that that every person with HIV and AIDS will be able to get insurance in ways that they were not able to before. So that's a huge thing. Two other things related to AIDS were the creation of a national AIDS strategy, something that had never existed in this country before, even though we insist on other countries who we give funding to on having them. And the third thing on AIDS is he lifted the HIV travel ban, which had been in place over two decades.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, he ordered the Department of Health and Human Services to issue a memo to all hospitals that receive government funding, which is almost every hospital, allowing for access to partners in healthcare, so for example, visitation in hospital settings. And in the international scene, the Hillary Clinton State Department, certainly at the direction of Obama as well, has really opened up the doors to the United States helping and documenting abuse in other countries, as well as supporting a gay organization's status as a non-governmental organization within the United Nations. That had been held up in the Bush years for many years. So that came through as well a few months ago. So those are some of the things internationally and nationally. There are dozens of other things that you could talk about in terms of policy changes that, for example, federal government employees, they don't have 100% of the same rights as straights because of the Defense of Marriage Act, but they do have a lot of the benefits in place. The Department of Housing and Urban Development has opened up to all sorts of families. And in all the cases where they've changed it to be non-discriminatory on gay issues, they've also added gender identity, so a lot of trans inclusion. He's also already appointed a record number of LGBT people to gay openly gay people to positions in government. He's already passed Clinton's years, and Clinton was in 8 years. So those people are in important positions, and some of them are in Senate-confirmed positions. For example, John Berry, who heads the Office of Professional Management. The policy changes that happened under Bush, I talk about this in a book a little bit. Molly Ivins, the late columnist, was brilliant at dissecting what Bush was doing across the board at every single level of government. He had people from industries regulating industries. So that affected oil industry and fishing industries, everything. Those minutia policies will take years to undo. But Obama has started by appointing people that are not conflicted, for the most part, in those areas, so that, you know, every single little policy change has to be reverted back, and that's not an easy process. But they have started to do that. So anyway, it's a whole range of things. It's not the big picture issues. The main big picture issue that he's gotten is the Hate Crimes Prevention Act, which, of course, is critical. And it was one of the big five. Now we have big four left on the table. Mm-hmm. But lots of other minor things have happened.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, like you're pulling through, just like I thought. You got a lot of wisdom there, and I want to tap as much as possible in the short time that we have together. Let's shift gears, and in your book, you talk about the racism that's in the gay community. And in your book, you also say you use the term gay to cover LGBT, which is lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about that. Over the years, starting back when you first came on the scene writing, the racism and how it has evolved, how it has progressed as you see it.
You know, I don't think, actually, that the racism is significantly changed for the better in the LGBT community. In Chicago in particular, we have a very segregated city based on race and class, and therefore it makes it very difficult to overcome those differences that people have, the baggage that they bring to the table. The white gay community still has the same kind of biases and baggage that the mainstream society has, and so I haven't really felt a lot of progress. I've felt pockets of progress have happened. For example, strong organizations that try to work across boundaries both ways. And there used to be an organization called the Color Triangle in Chicago that really aggressively worked and trained on these issues. But it really has not, you know, there doesn't seem to be a dent, really, in that. And that's something that again, overall society deals with these race and sex issues all the time, and mostly unsuccessfully. So I think the gay community is just as at fault for that. During this election cycle, I was interviewed a lot about Obama and the lack of support or the changing support in the gay community, and I said time and again that you can't believe that the gay community is monolithic at all. That the African-American gay community wasn't exhibiting that same hesitation, and the Latino gay community wasn't. Some pockets of the white community were, but not all. And some of those pockets of the gay community, I would say, come from two areas. One is some gay people are Republicans. So if you're going to ask them how they like Obama, well, they're not going to like him. And the second is those who came to Obama late in the campaign. Some people who were so passionately for other candidates, including Hillary Clinton, had a little bit less of a depth of support for Obama, so they were going to be more wary if he did anything that, you know, was hesitation on gay rights. So I think that was, those people were, less fully supportive of him, and I don't blame them if they came to him late in the game, and they are therefore don't trust him as much as someone who's been with him for a longer time or who could relate to him at a different level. So there is no one gay community. It's very frustrating to say, oh, all gays do one thing or another. Unfortunately and fortunately, we're diverse. So it helps us, but it also hurts us when we're trying to move forward. It's like moving 1,000 people forward on the marching line. You know, that's just not going to happen. Everybody's going to move at their own pace.
That is so true, yes. you touched on gender, but one of the things I'd like to hear you talk about is there a difference between the tensions that are around race versus the tensions, if there are any, I don't want to put any words into your mouth, around gender?
Oh, I definitely believe so. I think the Hillary Clinton campaign really kind of showed some of those tensions that exist between different communities. You know, who's going to be first? Is it going to be a woman? Is it going to be an African-American woman? You know, there was lots of tension, I think, from feminists who had worked so long and so hard to get a chance at the White House or at other levels of the government to see somebody, a newcomer, whatever race, a newcomer come along and just kind of usurp that from Hillary. So I think there was a lot of the sexism that happened in the 2008 campaign was almost more pervasive than the racism, only because people are less likely to admit to their racism or talk about it or confront or call someone whiny because they complain of a racist act. More likely, they did this time and again to Hillary's team. Oh, she's being whiny. Oh, she can't handle it. Oh, she can't handle a little sexism. Chris Matthews on MSNBC was brutal to Hillary during the campaign, and that was never called out by the mainstream media. They never said, oh, this is inappropriate. And Hillary, had she done a speech on sexism like Barack did on race, oh, my God, I think that would have killed her campaign on the spot. Yeah. It was appropriate for him to do, and it wasn't appropriate for her. So I think it's just a different kind of ism. They're both horrible, and they're both systemic and kind of permeate all places in society, but the response to it is different. And so anybody who tries to navigate those waters, whether on gender or race, really risks a landmine. Obama navigated it brilliantly during the 2008 campaign. And Hillary, it just hit her from so many sides, I don't think she was ever able to recover to be able to have a response that wasn't going to come back and bite her. So she mostly ignored it, whereas he was able to confront it head on.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of the media, so-called mainstream media, I think he got a light touch, and maybe race had something to do with it. There were a lot of questions that weren't raised or even explored while he was vying for the candidacy. For instance, his connection with Jeremiah Wright and some of the things that he said from the pulpit. What do you think about the way the media soft-touched it, I think, and didn't really do a lot of hard questions
in light
of how they did with Hillary, for that matter?
I do think they actually did go after Obama many times, but I think Obama's presidency was a charismatic presidency similar to Ronald Reagan's in that he was sort of Teflon on those issues. And people did report on all those things, but nothing ever stuck. Nothing ever made it past a certain place with Obama. And that was certainly luck, and it was also partly really his charisma that he won over some of the media, and he had this momentum behind him that was that didn't care. You know, so they might do a story but get no response, or, you know, nothing really happened, so it didn't go anywhere. He didn't take the bait. He was very good at just, you know, ignoring things, or when he did take control, he had brilliant speeches to handle it. It's amazing how different he is in office than he was as a candidate. You know, he did not take on the Tea Party when he should have, when they were just fledgling a year ago. That's when he could have nipped them in the bud, but he didn't, and neither did the progressive movement. Everybody kind of laughed at him, and look what happened. He needs to be running the campaign starting when he won, and he didn't. So I think that it was partly his personality. I don't think the media was light on him. I just think his stuff didn't stick.
Well, one of the things you said, and I want to touch on that and maybe push a little bit with it as well, is that he won the media, some of the media over. Like, I'm thinking of, I think, was it Chris Mathis who said he had a tingle up his leg or something? But do you think that's the place for media? And I'm speaking to you as a journalist. Do you think that the media has kind of lost its place in society because of that kind of admiration?
Well, I think the media right now is definitely kind of like a fish flapping on the ocean. It doesn't know which way to go. It doesn't know who's a journalist, who's a commentator, especially on the cable shows. You can't tell the difference between hosts and guests and journalists and commentators and paid consultants versus guests and all that stuff. It's murky, murky, murky on the national front. I think it is inappropriate for someone who says they're a journalist to be that way, but these folks think they're commentators and hosts, and it's certainly worse on the right-wing radio and right-wing TV. They do the same thing on the other side, so it's very difficult for somebody to try to operate in the middle like a CNN might try to, but they play into the same problems. If you treat someone who's a Looney Tune equal to someone who's not, that gives them credibility, and I think CNN sometimes walks that line where, come on, there's at least some news judgment here. They're distorting the facts. They're lying, and yet you're not questioning them on the spot. You know, you allow stuff to go unchallenged. So I think the whole media isn't in that kind of changing place where people are kind of becoming their own reporters and digging out information, which means that a ton of incorrect information is getting out there. And so I think during that 2008 campaign, what happened was, progressive media, anyway, really was enamored with Obama from his progressive roots and his anti-war stance. And Hillary Clinton had a lot of baggage with the media from her years before. And so she's not someone who's a suck-up. She's not someone who tries to be this charismatic leader. She just wants to get down and dirty and do the work. Well, the media want to be, at that level, want to be, you know, given face time, and they want to be schmoozed, and they, you know, want to like the person. And you know what? Hillary doesn't care if people like her. And Obama was well-liked. So in some ways it's about that cult of personality that people got kind of sucked into. I'm not saying Obama's not the real deal. I say in the book he is. But I think Hillary had a harder place to come from because she had been around longer and had more enemies and didn't really care about that.
Yeah, well, it was certainly, these are definitely very interesting times. And I think it started with the 2008. It really did. It was very interesting. One of the things that I'd like to touch on before you go is what do you see, where do you see journalism heading, say 10 years from now or 5 years from now, given where they are now? We have newspapers that are going belly up, television programs are fighting for ratings and not really getting the ratings. NPR is in trouble. Air America went belly up a couple of years back. Where do you see journalism 10 years from now, given what's going on now?
Yeah, I don't think anybody can predict, but I think journalism is going through a phase that's double whammy. One's the economy and one's the technology. I think it's kind of a similar change to what might have happened a few years ago in the music industry when the tools of distribution changed hands and became widely available. I think when I speak to journalist students right now, one of the things I say to them is, first of all, don't get just a journalism degree. You likely will not have a career exclusively in journalism. Or if you have a specialty in science or healthcare or business, you'll be able to get a specialty, you know, journalism track. Mm-hmm. But the second thing is, a journalist is someone who says they're a journalist. Same with a musician who maybe has a full-time 9-to-5 job but then goes and plays in a bar at night. And I think a lot of the future journalism will be done by part-time people and bloggers and people whose hobby, quote-unquote, it is to be a journalist, but that their full-time job can't support that. There just will not be the kind of number of jobs in journalism as there used to be in the future. It's a shame. I think some of the journalism changes will happen to a nonprofit model or a foundation-supported model as opposed to an advertiser-driven model. But, you know, for everybody out there in the media world, it's a drastic change. I'm going to a morning meeting tomorrow with the Association of Women Journalists of Chicago, and we're going to be talking about, you know, how do people position themselves, rebranding, how do you survive in this changing economy and media world. It's really scary for long time professional journalists who don't know what's going to happen to their careers.
Yeah. That is true, and I think that's true of a lot of people outside of the journalism profession as well. These are times that are exciting, and they are also very scary because we really don't know what's going to happen. We can only, you know, guess, take educated guesses.
Yeah.
One of the things we're going to do is wrap things up pretty soon, and I'd like to give you an opportunity to have a last say, or what would you like to leave our listeners with?
Well, the website for the book is obamaandthegays.com, all spelled out, and you can get it through Amazon or through Kindle, and I'm hoping it'll soon be available on iPad. And the website is going to have updates. The book was published in September, so it goes through mid-September in terms of content. And it also includes a lot of guest essays. I wrote about 80% of the book, but then also solicited guest articles and essays on various topics. So there's really terrific writers in there, like Carrie Elleveld from The Advocate and Lisa Keene, Chuck Colbert, Michelangelo Signorelli, Phil Wilson, Rod McCullum, a whole range of people that contributed essays or articles to the book. So it's really got a good set of viewpoints. And finally, the book also includes about 140 photos and images. So it's real fun to look at the old surveys that Obama filled out.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. I highly recommend the book. I do. And all the best to you. And I appreciate you coming on. And I wish you well.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, bye. Take care. That's all I have for you today. I hope you enjoyed the show. Visit my website at DeborahElek.com to find out more about Tracy and her book. And she just told you how to get her book. And if you missed that information, you can find the information at DeborahElek.com. Until next time, world.